This is our last Sunday of our winter study. Let me give you a little idea of the big picture of the method in our madness. About, oh man, this must be 10 years ago? Actually, it was a little more than, maybe 12 years ago. The session approached me and asked me if I'd be willing to lead a winter Sunday school through some of the bigger theological topics that are in our own denomination's confession of faith, called the Westminster Confession of Faith. This is the doctrinal statement, a theological foundation upon which this church is built. And so I said I'd be delighted to. We started our first series on the doctrine of Scripture, did an entire winter Sunday school on that. And then we just marched through it thematically, dealing with some of the topics that were there. Well, this represents not only the last Sunday school of this particular winter quarter, but the end of our trip to the confession. So I hope you've enjoyed this 12-year trip through the confession. What a wild ride it's been, right? I know you're all just riveted by it all. Of course, obviously, there was something that I couldn't do. When I took this job 2 years ago, Brian Sorgenfrey was nice enough to step in and sort of come in and help cover. We will probably just start over again, to be quite frank with you. Unless we sort of come to a different sort of way of dealing with our adult Sunday school classes, we'll probably start back over and march through some of this material. But the reason why we're kind of excited is because this whole series ends in one of our favorite sort of topics, and the topic of glorification. And that's what Brian has been doing for you. So today was intended to be the Q&A session. So this is one of those times where if you don't have any questions, then we're going to have a lot of awkward time meandering about and having to make small talk with people that, you know, you may or may not want to speak with. So let's just try to generate some kind of conversation. But Brian did let me do one small little thing in an add-on to his stuff on glorification. And quite frankly, it just gives me an excuse to show you this cartoon. So for the kids in the room, back in the day, there used to be a guy named Gary Larson who put together these single-panel cartoons called The Far Side. And this was just a very unique little slice of hilarity that would come in the newspapers. It wasn't quite as like, you know, kindergarten comics like Peanuts. Who read Peanuts as a child, right? Nor was it like overtly, nor was it overtly political like the Doonesbury people. You know, I always met the Doonesbury people because they had them up on their office walls. You're like, whatever, you're not that smart. The Far Side was for the alt crowd, you know, seeing the world through a little bit of a different weird eyes. And so Gary Larson had made a great career of what he was doing. But one of my all-time, I mean, top five favorite cartoons that he did was this one right here. So you got a guy here who has sort of made his way to heaven, we assume. He's got his halo, he got his wings, and he's sitting on his cloud in heaven. And of course, he thinks to himself, you know, I really wish I'd brought a magazine. The Karen gets it. She understood what The Far Side was about. I've always thought this was hilarious because in many ways it was kind of one of my questions, right? Really, like, what is it that you're going to do in heaven? And most of us, when we sort of default to something, we think about this guy who's like, well, not much, apparently. I got a cloud. I got a halo and wings. Oh, if I'd only brought a magazine to read while I was up here. It's Gary Larson's way of sort of poking fun. But I do want to mention just very, very briefly before we sort of get to your questions, I'm giving you 10 minutes to sort of cook up something to press through the awkward silence. I do want to spend just a very brief amount of time on talking about the activity of heaven. What exactly will we do in heaven? And the first one is a little bit inferential. The second one is straight out of a text in the Bible. Let me take the inferential one first. One of the things that we are very clear about in the Reformed tradition is that if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, and especially Genesis chapter 2, and you see how, in the sequence with which God created the heavens and the earth, one of the things that you'll notice is God commanded and created for Adam his need to work and to produce and to be fruitful and multiply, and that's not just about having children with his wife, Eve, but to actually go out into all of the world and mine the earth for the various material, the potentials that are there that God has implanted that we have no idea about. And we've been doing that for thousands and thousands of years, have we not? Living by this creation mandate. But here's what's important. The command to go out and to work, to have a job, to have a vocation, something that you go out and do and make your mark, was there before mankind fell into sin. It's a very, very big deal. The order there is very important. Why? Because for most of us, when we think of heaven, we're like, sweet. In heaven, I won't have to work anymore. I won't have to get it for this job. Man, I can't wait for heaven. I won't have to go to this deadbeat job. Now, look, that's a little bit of a complicated question, isn't it? Because in one sense, part of the frustration of our job is because of just human factors. Maybe I chose a wrong career. Maybe I picked something that really didn't fit me. We all go through that, don't we? But the other part of it is one of the reasons when man finally fell into sin, one of the things that God does in response to that fall is he actually curses man's work. So it's supposed to be frustrating. But when we start to talk about heaven, we need to assume the fact that this work that was given us to do will continue. But you got to imagine that it will be work without this curse of sin put into it. And for that, you've got to go through some different illustrations. And that is, when are the times in which I was doing work where the work that I was doing was its own reward and had nothing to do with the paycheck? Now, some of you are looking and being like, yep, never. That's not happened yet. Still waiting on that one there, Les. Really, though? I mean, when was the last time you... one of the weird little phases my father went through when I was in high school and college, for about a decade, he decided he was going to cook. Ginger's kind of like, when is that going to happen to you? Are you going to like really want to cook? But it really was funny how into it he got. Like, he got to where he was making his own bread and doing these loaves, and you give them away as like Christmas gifts and stuff, and it was fantastic. It's the kind of bread that had big holes in it, and you could toast it right up just right, and it was fresh. Put some butter on it. For Pete's sakes, it was the best. But he got into this weird sort of phase, and it was amazing that that was during a time when he was about as busy as he ever was. He was an accountant, and even during tax season, he'd be in there being like, oh, I'm just going to get in and make some bread. Be in the kitchen till 11 o'clock at night, working. Why? Because he loved it. It was almost like it wasn't work. You know, Dad used to always say this thing where he'd be like, son, I'm sure every dad says this to their children, you know, son, if you find a job that you love, you'll never work a day in your life. What does he mean? What does it look like when my work is stripped of all of the sin and the frustration? And according to Genesis chapter 3, the thorns and thistles that are in the earth that make my work frustrating. What does it look like without all that there? Answer, heaven. But I really think this is very important because it'll do two things. Number one, it'll make you realize that there really will be a sense of vocation there. This is not the vision, sitting around. And there's all kinds of ways in which we betray this. One of the ways in which we betray that is when we ask this question, well, I've been worrying, like, will we know each other in heaven? Now, why do people ask that question? We ask that question because we think to ourselves, well, because in heaven, right, we're just going to be these, like, I don't know, wafting spirits, you know, like wafting through eternity, and I'm just kind of this amorphous deal. I've got this present consciousness. Is that right? No. In that day, we'll actually have resurrection bodies, bodies which we assume will be continuous with the bodies that we have now. But the difference is they don't wear out, he said with incredibly sore shoulders. So I was telling the first service, and I'm going to say it again today, that I was out yesterday in Jonestown digging a garden, and I'm now paying the price of it. This is the curse at work. Thorns and thistles manifesting itself in my shoulders and in my back. Oh, anyway. What happens when work doesn't do that, but your body just gets better and better and better throughout eternity? That's something to look forward to, right? Second thing that it does is it'll change your way that you look at innovation. Christians really ought to be the ones who delight cautiously in innovation. Now, hear me very carefully here. I choose my words carefully. We ought to delight in creation. We ought to get excited about the fact that God has granted wisdom and insight to people all around the world, regardless of the people, whether they acknowledge Jesus as Lord or not, to discover stuff. And I'm not just talking about inventions. Yes, less the iPhone. Hooray for Steve Jobs, right? That may be part of it. It's an amazing thing. Transformed us, did it not? And then it transformed us. Then we're kind of like, yeah, but my cell phone drives me crazy. right. Because anytime human beings are involved in anything, we're going to get our fingerprints all over it. And somewhere there's going to be something that needs to be condemned, but something that can be commended, which is, by the way, true for everything. Some of you will hear a song, and you'll be like, oh, my word, this is the best song ever. I can't stop listening to it. And then you'll be reading some magazine and be like, oh, my word, the person who sings that song, they are awful. They are pro-life, or they're pro-choice. They're a Democrat. They're a Republican. I can't listen to that song. What? Look, here's the point. When you begin to realize that work will continue out beyond our present existence, you can get excited about innovation, but still keep the caution that probably I've got my dirty little fingers on it somewhere and it needs to be bettered. I think that's what we're living in right now when it comes to technology. We've over-adopted our technology probably in this era. Is that fair to say? You know, the first people to tell me about this was my teenagers. I'm not kidding about this. They were like, I am sick of social media. So just brace yourself. There's a new thing coming. If you're just now discovering it, you're a little behind. Because the kids have already looked and been like, this is gross. Now, are they still addicted to it? Yes. But it's just going to morph into something else. You know, that's how innovation ends up working. Okay? So that's the first thing that we will do in heaven, I think, is we'll continue to work. Who knows what we'll do? Who knows what gifts you'll discover that God gave you that you didn't get a chance to uncover? I don't know. That's kind of cool. Or that maybe you spent your life frustrated by. God, I slaved in this job all my life. For what? They gave me a watch when I retired. Thanks. Yeah. Sorry, I thought of another movie joke. Now I'm doing the movie thing. What's the second thing that we'll do in heaven? Well, this is sort of an old illustration of mine. Again, back to my father. My father's getting a lot of play tonight, this morning. I remember asking my dad, like, what we'll do in heaven. He was like, well, son, we'll spend an eternity praising God. And I was like, oh, okay. Anything else? Something else, please, maybe, hopefully? The prospect of praise and worship seemed a little dull to me, as it might seem to you, depending on your definition of it. But you get sort of a great picture here in Revelation 19, and this is probably worth taking a look at here. I just want to drive home a point you've heard me refer to in other sermons, but I want to kind of key on here this morning. Revelation 19. Yeah. Somebody else read. I'm going to give my voice as much break as we can. Somebody from the back who can read nice and loudly. Somebody, anyone? Gray, how are you feeling this morning? Is your throat sore? Give me 1 through 5. Okay, so there you go. That's the activity of heaven. Spent screaming out hallelujahs and going through the various aspects of the things that are worthy to be praised about. Okay, so C.S. Lewis is the first one who stumbles across this notion, and it's kind of in a little funnier part of mere Christianity, because he talks about this idea of going to be with God's people and singing and praising, and it's not mere Christianity, it's in his Reflections on the Psalms, and there's a psalm, and of course the good Bible students will know what this is, that goes, I was glad when they said to me, let us go into the house of the Lord. And the psalmist looked and said, man, just whatever we do, get me to Zion. Get me to Jerusalem so I can stand in the temples of the Lord and sing his praises. And Lewis said that when he first became a Christian, he was reading these psalms and he was like, okay, maybe, I don't know, maybe we should do something else. In other words, it didn't sound like it was a very interesting prospect until he really started digging deep and saying to himself, what exactly is meant by people who were thrilled? What is going on psychologically to a person who said, I really want to be in church with God's people singing praises? Because he said, you know, I find myself sort of sitting in church, and the only thing I can think about is how the guy right next to me is totally out of tune. That's all I can think about. Or that child 2 rows up will not stop fidgeting. And, you know, maybe those parents should be a little harsher on their kids. Don't act like you haven't done it. That was nervous laughter is what you heard just then. Who would do that? In other words, Lewis was like, my present experience in church and worship is not lending itself to excitement about it. And he said, what he began to do a deep dive in on what do we mean by praise and worship. And what he suddenly discovered is that when it really comes down to it, he said, I had to go back and look at what I enjoyed in life. And I had to go back and ask, what was it that I enjoyed about that enjoyment? Could be anything. It could be a great sunset. Let's say that you're a nature person and you get this adrenaline by going into these beautiful places where you see these amazing sunsets. Hey, look, Friday night, when the 25 of us were driving over into the Delta, man, it was a perfectly clear day. And if you hadn't driven west through the Delta at sunset, good night. Like, it was, even my 15-year-old son, right, was being like, Daddy, look at that. Sky just as red as it could be, and the red was on these little pools of water because of all the flooding last week. These cypress trees kind of coming up out of them. It was gorgeous. But here's the thing. Lewis said, if that's your enjoyment, he goes, have you really enjoyed it? If you cannot then turn to your neighbor and be like, do you see that? In other words, he says, you really haven't enjoyed it until you complete the enjoyment by telling somebody else how awesome it is. Now look, start to let this cook, and this will change the way you look at a whole lot of Bible, I promise you. How often is your enjoyment of something just not enough when it's all by yourself? And how much more fun does it feel when you can tell somebody else about what the enjoyment that you had, and they agree with you, and they laugh with you like, that's awesome. Yes, right? It just seems right to look at that Delta sunset and praise that thing. See where I'm going with this? Now, here's the crazy thing. You can do this about all of your enjoyments. Here's the deal. I promise you, you did not finish that fantastic binge Netflix show where you did not go to someone else and be like, did you watch so-and-so? You're not going to believe the ending. That's got us. My wife and I, we're marching all through that thing. We just blocked away all of Saturday. We're just going to watch it from beginning to end. Why do we do that? Because you haven't enjoyed the thing until you praise the thing. Follow that? Watch your enjoyments. Follow them. Follow that trace and see how you act in all of it and see how often it requires someone else to be a part of it. That's what's praise. Actually, here we go. Let's get the definitions down. Praise and worship. We talk about praise and worship. What's the difference? Worship is what happens inside of you when you find something that you think is cool, beautiful, lovely, praiseworthy, fascinating, hilarious, delightful. That thing that goes on inside of you where you get a little bit of a lift, you start mulling over it, you think over it, you make some connections, you seek out other things about it. That is worship, okay? It's not only sitting here on Sunday mornings with your hymnal open or your bulletin, like singing the songs. That's not all worship is. Worship is that mechanism inside of you that goes and gets your delights. And by the way, the mechanism the Bible says that is doing the worshiping is called your heart. Heart is not just where your emotions come from. It's where your delights grasp hold of things. Okay, that's worship. Praise is what comes out of your mouth when you're worshiping. Did you get that? So your worship is whatever happens inside of you when you find something delightful. Praise is what comes out of your mouth whenever you are worshiping. You say something about it. So do you recognize now how much of your day is spent praising and worshiping? Take religion out of it for just a second. You've been doing it a lot. Maybe you made a big sale, right? Maybe you landed a giant account, and you know there's a big old paycheck that's coming. My guess is you don't keep that to yourself. Your heart lit up. You begin to worship. You begin to delight in the fact of being like, oh, thank goodness. I think we're good for another quarter. You know, we're going to be fine now. Boy, this is going to create so many opportunities, man. If I get this client, good night, he's going to refer me to all these other clients. We're going to be set. And then all of a sudden, when I get home, I'm going to be like, hey, honey, guess what happened today? She's got to know about it. What am I doing? I'm praising what I'm worshiping. So much of the what I began to realize after reading this from Lewis was, like, most of my day is spent praising and worshiping something. And I hope you don't hear me saying, and those things are bad things if it's not Jesus. No, you just missed the point. I'm trying to say you've got this mechanism inside of you that is functioning in these praising worship all the time. But if you begin to take that sort of adoption, now I think you're ready to ask some very different questions about your faith. Because what that means then is what I'm sort of digging through in my faith is trying to find, okay, so in heaven, right, instead of longing for magazines, I'm going to be doing that enjoyable thing. It's a place of delight where I worship and praise all the time. So the question then is like, if I'm going to do that for eternity, what could possibly be that good? But I mean, that's the question. What could possibly be that good? And suddenly you've just turned into the best evangelist you ever worried you weren't. Okay? In other words, evangelism is nothing more than sort of coming. There's a sermon on this either next week or the next. In a couple weeks, we're going to talk about all about this. Evangelism is nothing more than letting someone else know what is good about what you've experienced. That's what it is. And so in heaven, if I know that's the activity that's coming, I suddenly reorient all of my, whatever I'm striving for. I'm really trying to kick this habit. Okay, that's a good thing. You know, obviously going to the Lord for that is a great spot. But eventually, that's got to come down to finding him delightful. Did I miss something along the way? And what might that be? Don't get me wrong. There's times in which the Bible can be very threatening and doesn't come happy-clappy. But I always describe those places in the Bible as smelling salts. Okay, so I was on the football team when I was in high school. I choose my words carefully. I was on the football team. I did not say that I played football. You're looking at this you know, muscular physique up here, and you're thinking, you play football. No, no, I was on the team. And one of the things that would happen periodically, is I would watch my fellow men out there on the field getting their heads banged in, right? And, you know, our trainer would rush out onto the thing when they would lay down on the ground, sort of out of it, a little bit confused. And he would take this little piece of cotton. It was about that big, had sort of a wax on the outside of it, and he would crack it. And then he would take it and wave it underneath the football player. It was ammonia, and it was awful. I smelled one time, and I was like, okay, that would wake me up too. That's what the Bible's threatenings are about. It's like, okay, you've gotten so encrusted in joys that actually are going to kill you rather than bless you that I need to wake you up. Boom, in comes judgment. In comes guilt. In comes that kind of shame that comes along with wrestling with an alienated person before God. But that's not where it ends. That can't be the substance. And if that is the substance of my Christian life, is hoping that, why is God in my life? Because you know what? If I don't have him threatening me, I mean, I would do a lot of damage. Really? Is that all it is? Because if that's your view, then probably this is your view of heaven. Because once the sin has gone away and done out, what else are we going to do? Right? This is what this cartoon lacks. It lacks the one thing that I found that was the most joyful, which according to Paul and the rest of the apostles, was Jesus. That sounds like a very Sunday school answer, but I really mean it in the least Sunday school answers I can. What could he possibly be talking about? Really, what might I find that could be that joyous that would carry me through an eternity where eternity would be too short to utter all his praise? Isn't that what the hymn writer says? So if nothing else, I think heaven ought to make us a little bit curious. What in the world might bring us to that particular point? Okay, so that was my brief little excursion into the activity of heaven. Work and praise. Work and worship. Kind of like a good title of a series or something there. All right, but this is our time to ask questions from the whole series. Now, I do have the disadvantage of not having sat through all of Brian's stuff. I heard like two or three of his Sunday school lessons, so I may be sort of thrown out. But whatever you've got, as you look through your notes and material that we talked about in glorification, I'd be glad to do my best, but I make no promises. Yes, Sam. It's one of the great mysteries. Sam's asking the question, what age will we be in heaven? You know, will the old guys get some years knocked off? No, you're not suggesting that you want to look different than you do right now. Your handsome self right now, Linda loves. and will the young kids kind of have some years put on? This is one of the great mysteries about age in heaven. What age will we be? Because the only person that we have as an analog to heavenly bodies was 33, and that's Jesus. So the 33-year-olds were like, yes, be awesome. Davis, how old are you? You're close, you know, just 5 more years, and you'll be at your ideal your ideal version. I don't have any idea, Sam. That's one that there's a lot of mystery about it. But yeah, what will be that sense of familiarity with a body that won't grow older? I just don't know. It's a great question. Yeah, it's great.
So when you're talking about
right. Yeah. I realize I'm definitely scratching where a scientist itch on that part. Be like, if you made your career out of sort of discovery and insight, it's just a cool thing. I don't see why that wouldn't be the case. What happens to the concept of time in a new heavens and a new earth? Is that bendable there?
I don't know.
But either way, it's cool. And I will say this, it's also cool when people speculate about it. Don't condescend to science fiction. Y'all watch this weird Star Trek stuff and Star Wars. I hate that junk. That stuff is terrible. I'm going to a spaceship and fly to the moon. Look, the desire that people have is to imagine a way in which we can. Some of you don't like my voices. A couple years ago, I found out. But there's two people inside me. There's a redneck and there's an old Miss Sorority girl, and they come out every now and then. There's really the only two voices that I do, but the redneck is the one that's the most prominent. I forgot what I was talking about. Just kind of left me. No, but the idea that there'll be something else to discover is what a science fiction writer is doing. What could be the possibility? What might happen if we could tweak this just a little bit? What gave him that instinct? I think the creative mind of God gave him that instinct. I mean, is it possible that when... I'll tell you what we were reading this week. I'm in this little read through the Bible in a year Slack group, and we were racing through Numbers this last week. We finished it up on Friday. And, you know, Numbers has this really weird story about Balaam. Do you remember Balaam? We always talk about Balaam's donkey, Balaam's ass. It's kind of the time you could say the word ass in church and get excited about it. You know, it's an amazing story because Balaam is a pagan prophet, okay? And you read the story, but he's bearing great witness to Yahweh, Israel's God, in very unbelievably specific ways. And not only that, he gets to a point where he makes some of the most vivid predictions about the great warrior coming out of Israel, which will stand on the earth and rule and set the world to rights. The pagan prophet. But I do think for some of us, we get very unnerved when we hear that there's a movie out there, and our first question is like, were there cuss words in it? That's a sorority girl. Sorry, that's the second one that came out right there. And here's my deal. Look, I think it's absolutely important not to expose myself to stuff that on a regular basis. There's a diet of trash that if I continue to do it, my mother's always like, garbage in, garbage out. I get that. It's absolutely true. But there is a way of consuming art around us from the pagan philosophers like Balaam without buying in wholesale into the worldview of Balaam. He bore witness to truth, right? He discovered research that's there. So just because that person was not a Christian, are they a Christian? I don't know, but this is good, right? The questions become different when we start to deal with art and food and music and culture at that point. They become more about like, okay, how do I view anything as a Christian? And you've heard my little cultural dialectic here, right? There are going to be some things that I can commend. Why? Because Jesus has already shown up and he's bearing witness and his grace is everywhere. But there'll also be something to condemn because it came out of a sinful human being. That's true for everything, y'all, not just... for years ago, a lot of people got bent out of shape about the Harry Potter books, you know? Whatever you do, keep your children away from Harry Potter because that's dangerous stuff. It's witchcraft. And on the side, I thought the Reformed folk are kind of looking at that and thinking to themselves, man, okay, maybe we don't want your children to become witches and warlocks. I'm not sure the way they're thinking that. But is it possible that even J.K. Rowling, in her sort of processing through this material, stumbles across God's common grace and truth? You better believe it. And every Christian delights to see that fingerprint. I don't necessarily buy into the worldview of demonology if I sort of consume some of those things. Now, does that mean that therefore, woo, Katie bar the door, you know, watch every terrible movie I ever saw? No. Of course we're sinful people. Of course there's guards that we have to put upon our souls to keep ourselves from stuff that would be damaging to us. But that's not the norm. I forgot what we were talking about now. I'm just talking right now. Just words coming out right now. Good question, Greg. Yes, yes, Ev. Yes, 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 yes. This is a very interesting question. And there's been a little bit of theological diversity. The Reformed have sort of taken a very clear path. That's one of the reasons I love the Reformed tradition, because it's like, let's just stick with the Bible. Where are people now who are between that time of having our resurrected new bodies and the time of their death? Where is Dad? I worry about where my dad is all the time. Think about him all the time. Can he see me? Is he aware? Does he see Luke learn to play the guitar? Like, that's the stuff that makes you cry. Luke has learned to play the guitar. It's just the coolest thing in the world. And I hate the fact that Granddad didn't get a chance to see Luke be able to play the guitar. But here's the thing. So what exactly is that state? Here's what we've got. We know for a fact that at the moment of my father's passing, 6-7 years ago, he was with the Lord. That's the promise Jesus makes to the thief on the cross. Today, you will be with me in paradise. And it's paradise. So it's not just with Jesus, it's also in bliss. Okay? Second thing. We also know that it is disembodied. Now, this is where it gets weird. That there is a separation that death does that is supremely unnatural. Your body and your soul being disconnected from each other ain't right. I don't like going to funerals where they're open caskets and being like, oh, he just looks so natural there. That's the least natural thing there could possibly be. Because there's a body here without a soul in it. That's the worst thing. That's our enemy. That's death. We don't get comfortable with that. But it does mean that there's a disembodied state. The question comes like, so what is that like? I don't know. But I'll say this. I do know. This is where I got to go get Tolkien here, okay? Because Tolkien had a pretty remarkable theology of the imagination. Bear with me for just one second. The Bible talks about faith as being a linchpin, does it not? You know, we embrace justification by grace through what? Through faith. That's a big deal. Our salvation is by grace through faith. Have you really stopped and asked yourself the question, what do I mean by that word? Well, you mean to trust him. Yeah. Okay, but what does that mean? What does it mean to trust him? Like, I'm trusting him right now. I'm going, right? Or don't doubt. That's why, by the way, your kids, they got to college and they left the faith because you told them that faith was not doubting. And that's not right. Faith, actually, one of the roads to faith can be the beginning to doubt. They need to be able to ask those questions in that moment. But here's my thing. Tolkien was the first one who said, one of the ways in which faith works is by this mechanism of our imaginations. And God gave it to us. And I think actually this is what Hebrews 11:1 is talking about. Faith is the evidence of things hoped for. What is that? How can I have evidence of something that I'm hoping will be there? I do that here. And the funny thing is I do it all the time in your imagination. When you wake up in the morning, I don't know what you do in the morning. Never mind what I do in the morning. But when you look at Ginger's like, get off Twitter the first thing in the morning. I know. I'm supposed to read the Bible first thing in the morning. But I usually open up, and I'm going to check my calendar that day and be like, what do I got today? What do I got today? And in my mind, I see myself having lunch with Victor. Okay, we scheduled it. We met a couple weeks ago. We're going to meet. We're going to go have lunch with Victor. Okay? And then what we do is, where do we decide we're going to have it? Okay, we're going to go to the Green Line because that's the only place Les eats, right? It's Green Line. He's trying to keep the girlish figure and eat salads all the time. So Victor, I see us there. I even think to myself, I'm probably going to get the exact same salad I get every single time. I'm trying to get them to name it the Lester. A salad. I'm not trying to do that. In other words, I have this. And then what I begin to do is I begin to live my day in accordance with that design. And I arrive, hopefully at the appointed time, to have lunch with Victor. You see how key my imagination was to the execution of my day. Which is why the Apostle Paul keeps coming along and saying to the saints who are in Corinth. And you're like, saints? Wow, thanks. Why? Because he wants you to see yourself in that way. Now, why am I going on with this? I do believe that there is a method of our imagination that puts us in touch with the state of our souls. And that active, alive part of us is what goes to be with Jesus. I don't think I can prove that, but it's as close as I can get. There's this thing inside of me called a soul. I access it when I pray. I access him when I pray. You want to talk about heaven and earth meeting together? You know, Jesus grants us the ability to say, our Father who art in heaven. Suddenly, that's where heaven and earth start to intersect. We'll talk about that in our sermon this morning. In other words, this is the one place where we can access it. Well, that access has got to stay there. So it makes me wonder, like I'd love to sort of patrol my inner world. How about that? What's going on between these, wherever you put it, heart, I don't care where you put it. What's going on here? Because that space, I think, is what ends up continuing on. Last thing, we also, I think, know in heaven that people are not satisfied with the way things are. Perfection in paradise does not imply that things are absolutely finished. Because in Revelation 6, we find out that there are souls of the departed who are underneath the altar. What are they saying underneath the altar? How long, O Lord? How long? When will you avenge our deaths? When will you go back and finally put an end to all of the sin and all of the death that has been reigning up until this time? When will you do that? And so there is a sense in which there's dissatisfaction. Now, why is that important? Because we need to be very careful about the way that we tell our people who have lost loved ones what that person thinks about them. My friend was at a funeral. He was actually preaching at a funeral when someone got up before he was to speak and looked down at, this was actually his sister-in-law, and looked down at his sister-in-law and said, I just want you to know, your husband doesn't miss you at all. He is up there in heaven praising God with the angels. He's not even thinking about you here. And my friend said he looked over at his sister-in-law and she just withered. She was like, I miss him a lot. So my friend gets up. This is just the way he's wired. Be thankful he's not your pastor. He got up and he goes, I love my brother and he's wrong. That's literally what he said. It's on the recording. And he's wrong. The Bible says that right now my brother is under the altar screaming out to God, when are you going to finally put an end to death? This is not the way it's supposed to be. What we're longing for is what God will do when he brings our souls back together, brand new bodies in the new heavens and the new earth, and we live forever happy and holy and with him. That's the difference. Mama, you missed me talking about Dad a whole bunch. I had a bunch of stuff from Dad. My mother just walked in the back of the Sunday school. It was all good stuff about Dad, so you missed it. Matt, what you got? Yeah. Yeah, the question was, how can you, the Bible says that God is the God who is making all things new, and it seems like the world's getting worse and worse. And I feel like I'm getting worse and worse. How can we say God's making all things new? A couple quick thoughts. The first is this. I do think that there should be some work done on newness as an eternal attribute of God, because that is a direct quote out of Revelation 21, that God, in the summation of all things, says, behold, I am making all things new. There is a newness to your God. He is in the business of taking things that are old and worn out and ruined and destroyed and making them new. That's the first point, the newness of our God. That ought to be up there with his kindness and his mercy and his severity and his wrath and his newness, because that's exactly who he is. Secondly, things are getting worse and worse. Well, be very careful. Things are getting worse and worse in America, or maybe in Oxford. But the light of the gospel has dawned in Africa. There are more Episcopalians in Nigeria worshiping this morning than there are in the worldwide Anglican Communion put together, of Britain and America together, in Nigeria alone. I didn't even know. Yeah, for those people, it's all new. Some of that paganism, that animism is being pushed out slowly but surely. The third thing is this. I do think that there's this interesting, constantly recycled paradox in God's people where we watch stuff get destroyed and God surprises us by renewing it at the last second. I think that's a Christian thing. Tolkien, again, called it the eucatastrophe, that we wait for that moment when all of a sudden everything looks like it's gonna be destroyed and victory is snatched from the jaws of defeat. And he makes all things new. And doesn't that happen in little microbursts throughout your life? I mean, think about those times. Where were you going before the Lord found you? You look back and be like, ooh, oh, I don't think about that. He made that new. But then you start looking at me like, yeah, but I'm falling apart. What about my death? What about the fact that I'm going to pass one day? Okay. I still wonder if the very first vision that I see in the microsecond after I close my eyes in death will not look back and be like, oh, he did it again. He renewed that even again. See, I think that's the pattern, that God allows this death to sort of move to a certain thing so he can show that he's the one that defeats it. Is that a decent answer? That was my stab at it. Can you validate me for that there, Matt? What time is it? Oh, I got a minute and a half left. Any last sort of quick, short thing? Clarification or not? Yes, yes, yes. Oh, sorry. We got two. All right, here we go. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah. When did people start losing their sense of there being a new heavens and a new earth? I do think that there were certain brands of fundamentalism that became, you know, so heavenly minded that they were no worldly good. You could probably attach it to a lot of American Christianity. One of the things that's very difficult about American Christianity is it had to wrestle with the individualism that founded our country, the sort of rugged individualism. We also have to deal with the fact that we felt a little secure in the fact that we enslaved a few million people while we did, and yet portrayed ourselves as a Christian nation. It's an interesting version of Christianity, isn't it? See, a lot of those things begin to sort of separate that what God really is interested in is in your spiritual state, but kind of what you do with your time and your money and your whatever else, you know, that's just one of those things. It's just passing away. This world is not my home. You know, I'm on that good old gospel ship, headed to heaven. That's where I'm headed. No, actually, this is what one theologian put it this way. You know, heaven is not your eternal state at all. A renewed earth is your eternal state. This place, the material world, will be renewed and remade and redone. The artists actually are a little bit ahead of you on this one. They see this. That's what they're engaging in. So are the musicians. So are the musicians, right? You're welcome. Nod. Exactly. Listen, tell me you ain't going to heaven this morning when you hear Pat sing in the second service. Good grief. Anyway, thanks. All right, let me close in prayer. Hey, thank y'all for participating. This was a great Sunday school season. We had more people involved in Sunday school than we've ever had, so I'm really delighted for y'all to dive into this topic. Remember, next week we split back up into the sections. So we got the young people in A1, A2, the middle class is here. The middle class, that's a funny name. And then we haven't figured out what did we figure out the name for the 55 and up? We're still working on it. So, but that'll be in the second room back there, so that'll be next week. Let me pray for you. Lord Jesus, give us the grace to see with new eyes, Father, to look at our destinies, whether, Father, our death is this afternoon or whether it's 50 years from now. We pray that we would long to see your face. And even if we don't even know what that means necessarily, we would love to know more. Father, thrill us. Make us to praise you by showing us just what's glorifying about you. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.